This is the MagicWordPodcast.com.
Hello, this is Scott Wells for the MagicWordPodcast.com. This week's episode is brought to you by the Friends of the Magic Word. Those are the people who pledge their financial support either by giving a donation or on a regular monthly basis. And we thank all of you guys for supporting us that way. But this week we want to welcome the newest friend of the Magic Word, and that is Dennis Bastable. Thank you very much, Dennis. I appreciate your contribution and your pledge to help with the finances for producing this podcast. And I also want to thank again all the people who are Friends of the Magic Word, and I want to thank those who even don't support us financially just because you're tuning in and listening. I appreciate you coming in, and you can do something for us then as well that would be just a little bit of your time. If you can go to iTunes, if you happen to be an iTunes user, or even if you go to the Play Store, if you're an Android user, and just leave us a 5-star rating and some sort of a positive comment, that will always help boost our rating. So thank you guys, however that you can support us, and we appreciate you tuning in each week and listening to The Magic Word. Well, today we are going to pick up the thread that we've been running for the last few weeks about expert at the card table, but don't worry, hey, this is not all about history or anything, so those of you who may not be interested in magic history, that don't tune out, because this is not going into that. Actually, this is going into something completely different, having to do with Guy Hollingworth and how that he had created his masterful classical look and the thinking that goes in behind the development of his routines and also the creative thought that goes into his original ideas that he puts into his act, and just the structure of that. But also, he is an expert at the card table, which is why I entitled this episode as The Expert at the Card Table, because, first of all, that he is certainly one of the preeminent card magicians in the world, and has a wonderful book called Drawing Room Deceptions, which is his one and only book at this point. He's got a set of lecture notes that's out, because when he was at the recent Magi Fest, he had sold those, but I believe he still has those available on his website if you're interested in learning some more from Guy and didn't get a chance to get his lecture notes if you were at the convention. Seemed like everybody was there. My gosh, it was like 1,200 people or something. Not like Blackpool with 4,500 people, but still, it was a large convention. Anyhow, also, the second reason is because that some years ago that he had a one-man show called Expert at the Card Table, and we get into that towards the end of this podcast about how that he had developed that and working. R. Paul Wilson had given him some ideas, and one thing kind of led to another. He was at a fringe festival. Anyhow, not going to spoil it. You're going to enjoy it. I hope you've enjoyed the last few weeks where we have been talking about the expert at the card table. First couple, of course, we're talking with Richard Hatch, and I have received several comments from many listeners out there who said that you guys really enjoyed those conversations with Richard, and also him talking about the historical people who have who are part of our rich texture of our heritage in magic. And then last week we had the episode talking with Hans from Germany, who is a filmmaker, talking about his documentary that he's working on in trying to discover who was this mysterious author, S.W. Erdenes. Well, anyhow, this week we're going to be talking with Guy Hollingworth, who happened to be, again, the guest of honor at the Magi Fest here in 2019 in Columbus, Ohio. And what was really pretty cool is I know that being the guest of honor with many people as there were at the convention, wanting to get just a snippet of his time and take a picture or talk with him, whatever. I didn't want to really carve out an hour of his time from the rest of the attendees. So he had a workshop that he stayed on and did. First of all, Juan Tamers did one on Sunday morning, and then he did his on Sunday afternoon. So the following morning on Monday, I stuck around for actually a couple of days in order to record this this chat, this conversation that we had. So I want to certainly thank Guy for his time that he had spent in hanging around, and I know hopefully he was well rested by the time that we had talked and kind of in the afterglow of the convention, so he can kind of wind down. So he was very relaxed whenever that we had a chance to chat. So he was not in a hurry to get any place except at the airport. So anyhow, I hope you guys enjoyed this as much as I did. It was great getting a chance to talk with a guy who, that if you don't know who Guy is, just go over to the website, you can get pictures you could see of him. He's often been compared to looking like Hugh Hugh Grant, both of them being from England, and of course, just strikingly handsome gentlemen. And certainly the guy Hollingworth looks like an actor as well, but he's not. He's a barrister. So I'm going to talk about that too. So you'll hear all that and more in this week's episode with Guy Hollingworth here on The Magic Word. Hello, this is Scott Wells for themagicwordpodcast.com. And today, again, gives me great pleasure. I've spoken with this gentleman only in short bits from time to time, and so it gives me great pleasure to actually sit down and have a chat with him properly. But by way of introduction, for those of you who don't know all of his background, just a little bit that it's important to know that, let's see. I'm going to read this as I've got it. As known to magicians throughout the world with his original close-up magic, which he's performed on TV shows such as The World's Greatest Magic and The 50 Greatest Magic Tricks, which earned him the prestigious international title, the Academy of Magical Arts Magician of the Year. Quite prestigious. But his inspiration ever since he was a child was actually the elegant sleight of hand stage magic of the 1920s and 1930s, which we refer to as the Golden Age of Magic. His brand new act combines original and skillful manipulation, for which he is known for the classical style of magic that perhaps our grandparents and great-grandparents might have seen. So, with that, I'm going to introduce someone who we're actually here at the Magi Fest in Columbus, Ohio, as we record this. He happens to be here in the States, all the way over from the UK. Please welcome my friend, our guest, Mr. Guy Hollingworth. Hi there, Guy.
Hi, great to be here.
And thank you very much for your time. I appreciate it. And thanks also for, you know, coming over for this convention. And you had a workshop then yesterday and had about 80 or so people, I guess.
I think
With that. And you were, how long is your workshop? About 4 hours, 3 hours, or?
Well, it very much depends on what people are interested in. I think we ran about 3 hours yesterday, but I don't do workshops particularly frequently. I did some last year in Japan, and they were a little longer, actually. We went nearly 6 hours on those.
Wow.
So it depends what people are interested in.
And so it kind of goes whichever direction, obviously, as opposed to a lecture where you're going to be having things outlined and going to cover these up points.
Yeah, exactly. I have a sort of list of things that I'm ready to talk about, but then if people want to talk about other things, we go off at a tangent and sort of see where we go.
Right. And the difference between a workshop and a lecture is more that it's a hands-on kind of a thing, where that you put cards in their hands, say, we're going to try this move or something kind of a
thing? Can be. Again, it varies a lot. So sometimes a workshop can literally be 6 or 10 people, in which case it's very much like that.
Right.
With a bigger one like this, when it's around 80 people, some of it we did sort of hands-on, but
right.
It's actually, it takes a while to sort of get everyone doing every move. So, you know, we did a mixture. We did some hands-on things and some more in a lecture style and
right.
some just questions and answers. So hopefully
right.
people got a bit of what they were interested in.
Going back for a moment, I was just thinking about the introduction that I was just reading over there about the classical style of magic that you do from the 20s and 30s. I was thinking of James DeMare also as another one who does classic bird act and kind of a thing. I think it'd be a great act sometime to put together some people like that, you know, who are magicians who specialize in just perfect classical kinds of, you know, billy ball manipulations and some dove act and, you know, classical tales and everything. Because when you wear tails, it's quite appropriate. You know, they're saying a lot of magicians shouldn't be wearing it because it's outdated. But if you're doing it in a particular style, it is absolutely perfect.
Yeah.
And so you have designed your show specifically to fit that era, I guess.
Yeah, well, I mean, the moment, I remember very clearly the moment when I thought I really want to do magic seriously, it was seeing a clip of Channing Pollock. He was always my main influence. And I did close-up magic mainly out of sort of necessity, if I'm honest. You know, as a young kid at school, I didn't really have the opportunity to, you know, be wearing tails and doing a
right.
stage act.
And it wouldn't look appropriate for a child.
Yeah,
necessarily.
Yeah. So all I had access to was a pack of cards, and, you know, so I started doing close-up card magic. But the reality is I always had at the back of my mind the idea I'd love to do a stage act at some point. And so, yeah, I mean, it's always been my aim to do that in the long run. But even when I was doing close-up magic professionally, I actually wore tails a lot of the time, even doing close-up magic.
Did you really?
Yeah, I did.
Huh.
Because particularly at sort of smarter events, quite often if it's a smart event or a black tie
wedding
dinner or something, you know, people will be wearing a dinner jacket or a tuxedo anyway. So just to be another person wearing another tuxedo, you know, you kind of blend in a bit, whereas wearing tails sort of sets you apart a bit. And I realized when I was doing that, actually, that does sort of tie in with people's perception of magicians. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it can be positive or it can be negative. You know, in some ways, if you're thought of as the dated, out-of-fashion guy who's stuck in the old days and wearing old-fashioned clothes and doing tedious tricks and cliched magic like pulling a rabbit out of the hat, mm-hmm. people can think of that as being a really sort of negative image.
Cheesy.
But equally, exactly, cheesy. Yeah. But actually, I think if you do it nicely and you sort of do it with some affection and hopefully do good magic at the same time, I think it does almost tap into people's idea mm-hmm. of what magic is. And that was very much what I wanted to do in my stage act. So the methods are mainly original methods. So it's not actually magic that would have been done in the 20s and 30s. But it's in that style. So I wanted it to be sort of modern methods that hopefully will fool people, but in a way that makes people think, oh yeah, this is the sort of thing that magicians do.
Right.
And I mean, I'm guessing no one has actually ever seen a magician pull a rabbit out of a top hat. And people who have seen it will think of it as being a very cheesy thing that mm-hmm. might be done at a children's birthday party.
Right.
But I'm hoping that actually building something like that into an act, it does, as I say, key into people's perceptions of it. And if you do it well in a way that hopefully fools people, I think that had the potential to be really interesting.
Right. It just occurred to me, you're talking about tapping into people's beliefs of what a classic style magician would be, but you're talking about adults, because I'm thinking millennials, for an example, mm-hmm. that their perception would be Dynamo, for an example, or somebody, maybe even Darren Brown, you know, that he appeals to that. My point being is that when they would see that, this almost would seem, I don't wonder if it's new to them, when mm-hmm. you know what I'm saying?
I understand what you're saying in terms of who they would think about as magicians that they will see on TV. But I still think, I mean, in culture in general, you know, you see on greetings cards or in cartoons or in comedy shows, you know, you mm-hmm. see references to sort of the old magicians and people with sort of names that end in I-N-I, you know, all that sort of stuff. I still think that's part of the sort of popular culture that people... It doesn't work. Guy Dini, maybe. That's the closest we can get.
It.
Yeah, that sort of stuff. I mean, you see that in comedy shows, people... And, you know, Modern Family, for instance, a series I really like.
I love the show.
Yeah, and yeah. So, you know, there are a few references that... I mean, there was an episode in particular, wasn't there, that Penn was in, I remember.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, there's the perception there of magic as being a bit outdated and a bit naff, a bit sort mm-hmm. of cheesy. And, what's the husband called?
He's a real estate agent.
Yeah,
and he's the one
exactly.
And his wife bought him a magic store, I think.
Right.
That was his lifelong dream.
Yeah.
And no one comes to the store.
He'll wear a cape and a top hat or something. Yeah, kind of thing.
Yeah.
But actually, so I think that's still an image that people... associate with magic, and if you kind of tap into that but then try and do it in a way that actually people go, oh, actually this is much cooler than I thought,
mm-hmm.
that's
mm-hmm.
that's what I hope it is the idea.
I believe they do, because they're probably, particularly if you are in a variety show and they're seeing other kinds of magicians who are maybe doing some illusions and doing some comedy and everything, and then when they see that, it's kind of like, oh, you know, there's no laughter during your show. I mean, there are not comedy points particularly, as it would be in something that's structured to be comedy specifically, but people might be laughing at the surprise. I think it was Vernon was talking about how that laughter is an outgrowth of the surprise. I mean, you know, flight, fight, or freeze, you know, that in this case, that's like, I don't know how to react other than applaud and to laugh because I'm surprised. And so that's part of a reaction, I think. And so I think people would. My point is that you're not structuring your show as being comedy. So when they see that, they stop and say, wow, this is really different and classical. I think we could see that.
Yeah, well, I've sort of designed the act in a sort of modular style. So there are three sections, and during those three sections, they're done to music, and there's a discrete effect performed for each one.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly during those, it's not really intended to be. There are a few sort of lighthearted moments, but I'm certainly not going for belly laughs.
Right.
And then in between them, I talk. And again, the talking is supposed to be lighthearted, and I hope people will kind of be amused by it, but I'm certainly not going for a full-on laughter.
Of course.
Sort of comedy effect, yeah.
Right. And speaking of the music, then, when your selection of that, do you listen to a lot of that style of music from that era and think, oh, this would be perfect? And you know, like sometimes I will hear music and I'll think, you know, I can imagine doing... Subtrunk to that, let's say, or whatever, you know. Or this would be good background music for a mentalism piece that'd be a little bit, you know, softer or whatever. You know, mm-hmm. that sometimes my parts of my show would be inspired by music, right, as opposed to having something then looking for the music, because something seems to sometimes fit.
I wouldn't say it happened exactly like that, but certainly, yes, I mean, I enjoy listening to music. I like listening to film music a lot, actually. I listen to film scores. So the music, most of the music that I use, although it's supposed to feel of that period, sort of 20s and 30s, I don't want the whole thing to actually be a sort of a pastiche. I don't want it to feel like I'm actually pretending I'm in the 1920s.
Right.
I want people to realize, you know, you're watching something that's happening now, but it sort of is in that style. And so consistently with that, I didn't want to use music from the 1920s and 30s. One of the pieces actually is, but it's been used in films more recently, so I think it feels a bit more contemporary.
But people can relate to that too, because when they hear that music, that's part of the thing, is that when they hear that song again, if it is a contemporary song, they'll say, I remember seeing this magician, Guy Hollingworth.
Right.
Yeah.
But most of the music is from film scores. So it's been written, it's fairly contemporary music, but written to be evocative of that era. And that's kind of exactly what I'm trying to do. I want it to be contemporary, but evocative of that era. So, you know, it has the feel of it without, as I say, being a pastiche.
Yeah, like whenever I hear Gershwin, Rhapsody in Blue, I will be thinking, you know, of James DeMare's act, you know,
right,
Bird Vanish and everything at the end and whatnot. So, yeah, when you hear, you know, certain music, that it would kind of be evocative of that that era and that and that show, you know, then as well. And so those are some original methods that you kind of had an idea of developing yourself?
It's been a combination of things. You know, there are three sections. There's a card section, a billiard ball section, and it's a newspaper section, which goes into a production of a hat. And so I had the props in mind fairly early on, because once I'd kind of figured out I wanted to be in tails and do something that was quite classical, and I knew I wanted to have discrete effects. You know, I think some manipulation acts can be a little confusing. There's a lot happening at the same time. You know, there's a fan of cards produced, and then now there's a candle, and then there's a dove, and then there's another fan of cards. And
it can be confusing.
You know, I'm never quite sure what's happening. So I wanted them to be fairly clear effects, and that's why I do them separately, and I talk in between them, so that, you know, they are discrete effects. So I knew I was going to do something with cards. Billiard balls just seemed like a very obvious choice of that fitted with the aesthetic. And I knew I wanted the rabbit with a top hat, and that sort of led me into thinking how I could get into that. And I was thinking about the black and white color scheme. And I had this idea of doing a torn and restored newspaper. And I thought, well, it'd be quite fun to do a torn and restored newspaper slightly in the style of the torn and restored card that I do. So it's a sort of piece-by-piece restoration.
Yeah, it's completely different from what that I've seen in the newspaper ever before.
Right. Oh, thanks.
Yeah,
it was that was the idea. So I had the sort of the overall structure in mind fairly early on. I thought about some other things I could have done. I thought maybe, you know, linking rings would be something that would fit with the aesthetic, but I couldn't find any sort of anything particularly new or something that I thought would be really interesting to do with that.
That hasn't already been done.
Yeah, I've still got it in mind, and I'm sort of playing with it a bit. But at the moment, and again, the nice thing with it being sort of a modular act is, you know, I can always drop in a new section and keep two of the last bits without having to remix all the music and everything. So, you know, that's one of the advantages of it. But yeah, those were sort of ideas that I had for the props pretty early on. And it was a combination of, you know, sometimes when I'm trying to think of an effect, I'll, you know, have a very clear effect in mind and then simply work on the method. Sometimes it's a little bit more organic than that. And certainly with the cards, I had the idea that I wanted to do a fairly simple effect where four cards are produced and they vanish and get reproduced again.
In that regard, I heard someone after the show was saying that, first of all, every one of your pieces were so clear that it was understandable what happened afterwards. Like, I could describe what happened, but as to that particular effect, I didn't mean to interrupt, but they said that whenever that you had these four distinct cards and they vanished and reproduced, they were the same cards, and they continued to reappear, as opposed to some other generic card from a stage thinking no one will notice the difference. Like, yeah, we did, and they were all the same, and it was that subtly. It's like, wow, that was really clear.
Oh, that's good to hear. Yeah, I mean, it's obviously, it is intended as a stage act, and I can do it on a small stage for 40, 50 people, or I've done it in big stages for, you know, over 1,000 people.
Yeah.
So you don't need to be able to see the cards. It's not something where, you know, the cards are chosen cards or a prediction or something. So if you just are sitting further back and you can just see them as objects, it's fine. But I'm interested to hear that because a lot of people have said to me, why do you bother with that? Because no one can see what they are. But I've always assumed that people can see what the cards are. So, yeah, I have four cards and, yeah, they disappear. And then the four cards that I reproduce, they're the same four cards. And, that's very much something that I hope people would notice. So it's good to hear that they do. That was something that was the first part that I developed. And it used some of the methods that I've already used in close-up or sort of parlor magic. So that was the one I sort of felt most confident with because it was most similar to what I've done before. Then the billiard balls I sort of had the idea for quite some time ago. I needed to get a few bits of apparatus made, a nice box to put them in and things like that. So it took me a while to sort of, I made a few versions in cardboard and then I got it made a couple of years back. And the one that took me the longest was actually the newspaper to get that sorted out.
Yeah, and again, as you were doing that, I thought, oh, it's like a jumbo torn restored card.
Right.
You know, that you do. It was beautiful. Yeah. In that regard, I wanted to talk a little bit about that then, too. You described that, I believe, in your book, in Deception, Drawing Wind Deception. Among other things, which is a tremendous book. It's one of those things kind of like Bob Cassidy's book that I just like to digest and read a few chapters and then go to the next one to kind of, as opposed to just being trying to take a drink from a fire hose, you know, because there's so many good things. As you know, sometimes you go through a book and you read, that's good, that's interesting, and kind of go on or whatever. But there are a lot of really good things. For an example, the thing that you were talking about in the lecture, where that it is a dual reality of one thing where that the audience sees something different from what the person on stage does. Excellent. I always loved that idea. And to see you talk about that in lecture, that reminded me of that again, and so I got a deck of cards, and so I'm ready to go. start working on that. Again, I had forgotten how good that was. But as to the Torn Restored card, I remember that was why that the book really sold very well. I assume, how many editions have you had of that? Or
I think Mike Caveney has just done the eighth run, I think.
So he probably has about 1,000 each time, so he's doing pretty well.
I honestly don't know the numbers. Yeah. I think maybe I'm sure at the beginning they were printed in reasonable numbers. I suspect the more recent ones may not have been as much as 1,000, but I don't know, to be honest.
Like with us, you know, with Banachek, with our books on psychological subtleties, that our first run was 2,000. After that, we just do 1,000 each time. But we continue, as long as they sell. I mean, no sense having a lot in stock because you're right, the first run is good. But what I'm ultimately getting to is when you, I assume, counseled or conferred with David Copperfield when he did that Honus Wagner Torn Restored baseball card, had he seen that, had come to you? Was the book out first or did it come out later?
No, they were completely the other way around. Okay. So that came out first, and that was sort of a large part of my inspiration behind it, was that I'd seen that. And I thought, that's a great premise of tearing a card and putting it back together one piece at a time. I'd never seen anything like that. I mean, I had no idea how that trick was done. I've got a bit of an idea, but I still don't know any of the detail of the method. Mm-hmm. But I'm pretty sure that it's not something that could be done on a regular live basis. You know, it's a great TV trick, but I don't think that method would work.
That was not something that was part of your expert at the card table that you were doing your show. I mean, you had not later done that trick. I mean, the Torn Restored card is part of, we'll get to that later, you know, the your stage show that you were doing. Do you have that as part of that show or not?
Yeah, it's okay. It's in that, absolutely.
Okay, so go back, I'm sorry.
Sure. So no, the version, the David Copperfield effect, the Chris Kenner effect with the baseball card, I thought looked great, but I not know how it was done. I understood that the method was one that couldn't have been used if I was sort of walking around tables at a party or whatever. That was the premise. So I thought, wouldn't it be cool if I could actually do a Torn and Restored card where you put the pieces together one part at a time, but in a way that I could do it if I was doing a banquet or a restaurant or whatever. Mm-hmm. So that was kind of the idea behind it. And I then just played around while I was at university with methods to try and figure out if there was a way that I could do a live version of it. Mm-hmm. So, I had absolutely nothing to do a while later when David Copperfield came to the UK, I had a call from Chris Kenner, and he said, would you like to come and see the show, which was very kind of him, and to show David Copperfield the trick then. So it was completely the other way around.
Did he later start performing that as part of his regular show, I mean, in using your method?
No.
That was it? You just kind of had a conversation, said thanks?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. Yeah, for some reason, I always thought that, in my mind, that your name was in the credits of saying, you know, it was...
No, they've been
completely
independent.
Okay, well, that clears that up. It's interesting. And with other kinds of ideas. Now, that was your first book. It was. Have you had others? That's the only one I have, or I know of.
Yeah, no, that, I've only done one book. I've had other sets of lecture notes and bits and pieces, but I've only had one book. I'd love to do another one. I'm sort of thinking. I've been putting together some material more recently and sketching out how it might fit together into a book. And so I'd love to at some point, you know, it's not imminent, but I would love to do another book. But yeah so far
nothing,
it's just been one.
Nothing that's kind of in the computer right now that you're kind of, you may be toying with, but it's not like Eric Mead's book on Tim Conover that it's coming in the future and he keeps talking about it, but it's not like that.
It's not like that yet. I mean, I've got as far as setting up a Dropbox folder, which every now and then I'll sort of upload something to and think, you know, oh yeah, that. So I've got a kind of outline contents page and I'm thinking about how it would be structured and I've, you know, started writing a few little bits, but it's very early stages.
Gotcha. I want to talk about the Expert at the Card Table show, but beforehand, just to clarify and for my self, as far as your background, a barrister, then right now, that I'm uncertain what a solicitor versus a barrister and what are the, because it's different in the U.S. as to the U.K.
Yeah, exactly. So we have, the legal profession is split in the U.K. into barristers and solicitors. So solicitors tend to work in law firms much in the same way as in the U.S. So, you know, like an attorney will generally be part of a law firm. Solicitors will usually work in law firms, and a lot of the big American firms have offices in London. So,
solicitors, they do a lot of research and that kind of a thing too.
Well, so it's probably easier to describe what the barrister is. The barrister is the person who will actually argue the case in court. I'm the one who actually will stand up and make the arguments.
So
a silk is, if you become a senior barrister, then it's called becoming a silk because you get to wear a slightly different gown, which is made of silk. So it's actually, you're called a QC, which is a Queen's Counsel.
Okay.
So a QC and a silk is the same thing. So that's a senior barrister. So if you're not a silk, you're just a junior barrister.
And they wear the wigs.
And all barristers, you wear the wigs and the gowns when you're arguing at a trial. Okay. And nowadays, you don't wear them every time you go to court. In the old days, whenever you were in court, you wore your wigs and gown. But now it's only for a trial or an appeal when you're doing any sort of smaller hearing or something about disclosure or discovery, as it's called here, that sort of stuff. You don't wear the full kit. So we're responsible for the actual case in court, which means that we're often involved throughout the preparation of the case. We'll give advice on evidence and discuss with, you know, what things need to be disclosed and how the case should be put together. But ultimately, our clients are the solicitors. The solicitors are the people who have the direct contact with the actual client whose case you're arguing. So I don't run the case on a day-to-day basis. I'm not involved in writing letters to the other side and in communicating with the client. I'm sort of in an advisory role throughout most of it, and then I turn up and argue the case. So, and barristers are typically self-employed. So we don't work for the law firms. Things have changed, and now there are solicitors who can have what are called rights of audience, so they can actually argue the case. And equally, you can law firms will employ barristers to work in-house. So the lines are becoming a bit more blurred. But traditionally, the barristers will not work in firms. They work in groups called sets of chambers, and we're self-employed. And as I say, we are then hired by the solicitors to argue a particular case. And the advantage of that is that being self-employed, at least in theory, I'm able to take some time to do some magic. I don't have a boss as such.
Okay.
Obviously, there are other people that I work with, and I can't take liberties. I can't just disappear for months at a time. But
you have to coordinate your schedule with them.
Exactly. Provided I coordinate with the clerks in chambers, who are the ones, they're sort of a bit like agents. You know, they're responsible for running my diary and getting work. And provided I sort of keep them in the loop and I'm not taking liberties, it does mean it's possible for me to do some magic alongside doing law. So that's really great for me. And it's very important to me that I be able to continue to do some magic as well as doing law.
Right. Well, okay, interesting. So a QC, again, is that something that is an elected, is an appointed position?
You have to apply to become a QC.
Okay.
And
how many of them are there at a time?
They may be about a... Oh, I'm not sure. Actually, they were just announced. This year's were announced only a week or two ago, so I ought to know. It's probably around about 100, I would say. You know, it's not a large number mm-hmm. who are appointed in a year. Maybe it's not quite that many. I'm honestly not sure, but it's that order of magnitude. There are fewer barristers than there are solicitors. It's the smaller side of the profession by quite a big margin.
And even fewer yet QC.
I'm sorry?
And in fewer yet.
Exactly, fewer yet, yes. So it's something that in the old days, it was really done, it was not at all... it didn't comply with equality and diversity rules, shall we say. Okay. It was very much sort of a tap on the shoulder uh-huh. and a bit of the old
political.
Boys network
yeah, exactly.
and all that sort of stuff. Mm-hmm. So it's been overhauled in recent years, and it's now a very thorough process where you have to apply and show your credentials and put forward lots of references. And it's a long process now to go through, and it's really quite tough.
And once you are, you stay at that level?
And then you stay at QC.
So, but there's a new group that's kind of inaugurated each year?
Exactly. So every year there's a new round of appointments. I'm at about that point in my career where a lot of my contemporaries are applying and are becoming QCs. Mm-hmm. At the moment, I haven't wanted to apply because it's a very challenging thing to make the application. Mm-hmm. And the other thing is that actually when you then become a QC, ironically, you're almost... starting your career again in that, you know, suddenly all the people who knew you as a good junior barrister are now thinking, well, do we actually, you know, do we need someone who's probably now charging more money because they're a QC?
Sure.
And if we were going to get a QC, don't we want someone who's really experienced as a QC? So it's actually, funnily enough, it can be quite a challenge uh-huh. to, you know, most people succeed very, very well, but it means... You know, when I started at the bar, I really had to stop doing magic for a while to really kind of establish myself. So I didn't do magic seriously for about 10 years. I mean, I did a little bit, but I kind of thought I really need to take it seriously. And my concern is that I think, you know, I'm in a pretty good place at the moment, that I've got a nice balance between doing law and doing magic.
Right.
And to put aside a lot of time to apply to become a QC, and, you know, there's no guarantee that you'd get it. But then if you do get it, then you've got that concern of, should I really be going off and doing this show?
You might have some struggling.
It might be a bit of a struggle to keep it going. So I'm not sure what my plans will be in the future. But, yeah, it's kind of, that's the time I'm at.
Because I was recently just speaking with Uri Geller, and Uri was saying his son, apparently, I think, is going to be a Queen's Counsel.
Oh, really?
It was something, I guess, he wasn't quite certain whether that was going to be happening.
Said, oh, I see. Okay.
Yeah. I don't know if they were really talking about it. So, yeah, keeping their fingers crossed, you know, whatever. So, but I didn't understand what that was, I think, until you just had said that, because he was saying, well, something, you know, tantamount to the U.S. of being like the attorney general to the president. I mean, it was some high office, something to the queen, but that makes more sense, being a queen's counsel, being part of this group, as opposed to being the one person.
Right, yes. It's certainly not like an appointment. I mean, we do have, there are roles like that, but no, being a QC is, it basically just means you're a senior barrister.
Gotcha. Yeah. Okay. When we talked earlier before we got on the microphone here and started recording, I remember at the centenary for the Magic Circle some years ago, which was still perhaps one of the best conventions I've ever attended. It was a one-off ever, you know, just the 100th anniversary when they really did shorter talks and they had great conversations. And David Berglas did his, you know, floating table and other mm-hmm. kinds of things. I remember, you know, John Calvert was interviewed by, I think maybe David Berglas, or no, it wasn't. It was forgotten who all. Anyhow, it was great. But you had a short talk that you said you'd just kind of given as a one-off, but it was something that had really influenced my thinking a little bit as to how I view magic and would create things by taking things out of the box, and that, you said, came from your industrial design background?
Yeah, that's right.
Can you talk about that just a little second?
Sure. So when I finished at school, I honestly wasn't sure. I kind of assumed that I'd go to university at that point, but I really didn't know what I was going to study. Mm-hmm. And we don't have the same system here of being able to do a major and minor subject.
Right.
You know, we have to choose one subject to do. And I really found it difficult to know what I wanted to study, because I enjoy the creative side of things and the sort of the artistic side of things, but in some ways I think I'm probably a bit more scientific, and maybe that's where I'm better at in some ways. So I really struggled to find a subject to study, and I was thinking about doing architecture. Because it seemed to combine
drafting and drawing.
Well, it combined the sort of the artistic and the original side of, you know, coming up with new designs for things, with the more scientific side of making sure that the building doesn't fall down, you know, all that kind of stuff. So I was thinking about doing that, but it was a very, very long course, and there were not very many career opportunities at that time. And I suddenly heard about this thing called industrial design that I didn't even know was a course.
Mm-hmm.
which is, you know, apply. It's the same sort of things, but it's to objects rather than to buildings.
And which school was this? Where were we going?
So this was at, I went to a place called Brunel University that isn't sort of known for engineering and that kind of stuff. Okay. So I applied to do this course there, and it was interesting because it was a real mixture of the creative and aesthetic side of design and ergonomics and graphic design with the very scientific side of, you know, the material sciences, electronics, computing, even neural networks, sort of early days of artificial intelligence, those sorts of things. Hmm. So it was a very wide and interesting course. But in the course of doing it, we were expected to come up with loads of new ideas for things. And part of the course was about a design process, which can include how to generate ideas. You know, if someone says, I want you to go and design a new kettle.
Okay.
How do you even start that? We all know what a kettle is. You know, it looks like a jug, but it's you've got a plug in it and with a handle and a spout, and that's right. So, you know, and one of the exercises we had, actually, it was a water filter, not a kettle.
That's what it was. I was thinking, it was a coffee maker where there was water and then the grounds and then the coffee.
Right,
maybe
exactly.
It was a water filter.
I think it was a water filter.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So one of the things they said is, right, we want you all to go away and come up with 10 new concepts for a water filter.
Mm-hmm.
And you think, are there even 10 concepts, let alone 100 students all going away and all coming up with 10 different concepts
mm-hmm.
each.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the things that we were taught was some ways of generating ideas, just coming up with new ways of doing things. And most of them will be rubbish, but it's just a way of coming up with these things that you then
can
evaluate.
That's what brainstorming is all about, too.
Exactly. So brainstorming
don't
is part of it as well.
Don't throw away any bad idea, because there are no bad ideas until the end.
Right.
Yeah.
So generating ideas, then evaluating them, and then actually, how do you then work out what is a good idea? Once you've brainstormed them, yeah, fine, you've got all these ideas. At what point do you go, fine, well, this is not going to work, I'm going to set that aside. How do you actually evaluate it? Even before that, how do you identify where there is an opportunity in the market to come up with something? Does the world need a new type of water filter? You know, those sorts of things.
Right.
And then even when you have designed it, what do you then do? How do you then make sure that it's as good as possible, that it's manufactured as cheaply as possible, and that it's as safe as possible, and that you've thought about what are all the things that could go wrong, and how do I stop that from happening?
Mm-hmm.
So all of those things, those are all parts of processes which, in the design field, there's a lot of learning on and research and studies, and people have published a lot about all of those different processes. So we were sort of taught that in outline, that whole process. And I just thought to myself, well, that would be really interesting to apply that to magic. You know, how do you identify what's a trick that's even, what kind of trick is worth even pursuing?
Mm-hmm.
And then once you think about, well, maybe no one's doing this, maybe this would be a cool idea. How do you then come up with ideas for creating that?
Yeah.
You know, first of all, the effect, and then it's almost you start all over again for the method. Then how
correct.
Do you do it with that? And at each stage, how do you evaluate? Is this worth pursuing? Is it a good idea? And then how do you make it better? And how do you go through and think of all the things that could go wrong? And how do I avoid that happening? So that was the idea, was to apply that sort of fairly rigorous approach to the creation of a magic trick.
Yes.
And I did it sort of with a case study, which started with the idea that I think is a fairly common problem. How do you approach a table if you're working in a restaurant, or you're doing any kind of, you know, table hopping magic or whatever
right.
it's called these
right.
days? You know, that sort of thing. That's a problem, and a lot of design comes from solving a problem. So that was how it started, and then I sort of evaluated it and went through this whole process and came up with an effect at the end of the talk, which was, you know, one way of addressing that problem, and a trick and a method for it as well. So that was the premise behind the talk. And I found it an interesting thing to do, and people have told me they found it interesting to listen to. I mean, I have to be honest, I by no means go through that process when I'm coming up with with a new effect. I think all of those things along the line are interesting sort of tools to have. It's interesting to be aware of and to think about it, but it certainly wasn't my intention to sort of say, because I published a little booklet that went along with it. It was certainly not my intention to say, you know, this is how one ought to create magic.
Right,
it was not
right.
sort of
it
supposed to be didactic.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it was just sort of some ideas about that's how things are designed in the design world.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, because I remember that some of the photos or pictures that you had shown up there where, you know, the water would come through and then it would be filtered here and the water comes out the bottom traditionally,
yes.
you know, but they could be lined side by side or in reverse order or going up rather than down or having two stacked and then one or whatever. So
yeah.
that being just an idea of how you might think about magic. So anyhow, I just thought that was quite interesting about how that, you know, you would design things differently as a magician when you're structuring. Because sometimes you might come up, let's say, with a presentation before that you, or you might hear the music like we were talking about a while ago that will inspire something.
Yes.
And sometimes there might be something in life that you see and say, well, if this could be done or appear magically, how would that look and how would I go about that? Sometimes you have a method with no effect, or sometimes an effect with no method. And you know, you have to back into it. So you have to keep your mind open to all these possibilities about how that you can create.
Yes.
You know.
Well, I mean, that has always stuck with me as an example as well. So yeah, the water filter, one of the techniques was literally to break things down into blocks. So with a water filter, what have you got? You've got a place where you put water in, you've got a place where you take water out, and you've got some kind of device that will filter the water. So you've got three items, let's just call them A, B, and C.
Yeah.
You just then take a piece of paper and you just draw square blocks labeled A, B, and C in all kinds of different permutations. You know, you put one to the side, one on top. You put one inside another. You put all three, one inside one and one inside the other. Mm-hmm. You put two inside one and one. You literally just jumble up all the elements. Mm-hmm. And then you take a step back and say, well, what would that actually mean if I now go back to saying, so A is where I put the water in. B is that, so maybe I could actually have a sort of a tank inside there, or maybe in the handle, I could actually put the filter in the handle. So that actually means I've got more room for the main water in the vessel, and it could go around the side, you know, if I put it off to one side, you know, those kinds of, kind of things that you come up with.
Yeah.
And that was very much what I thought of with magic, both in terms of, like you were saying with the effect, you know, you can just take some objects, just take some interesting objects and just jumble them up. So what, you know, what would an effect be if I put this here and this then ended up there?
Right.
And then also with methods. So in the trick that I was dealing with, a torn and restored card, totally different to the Reformation, but the effect that I was doing for the approaching the table was to do with the torn and restored card. Mm-hmm. And I was just thinking, well, what are the elements of that? So I've got an untorn card that I'm then going to tear into pieces. So I've got these pieces I need to get rid of. I've got then a restored card. I want to have some kind of effect, so maybe put a flash in there as well. So, you know, you literally break it down into elements,
right.
Just label them A, B, and C, and just then jumble them up and see what happens and think, well, so maybe I could I put this inside the card? Could I put the restored piece inside that one? Could that be clipped behind it or alongside? You know, just all those kinds of permutations.
Sure.
That was, part of the thinking behind it.
Brilliant. I hope people are listening to this and digesting that, because, again, that just kind of rocked me when I started thinking about that. And that was, what year was that? That must have been 2000 or 99, 98?
I think it was a little later than that. I think, for some reason, 2005 is coming to mind, but I don't know. It was sometime around then.
I think you're right, around that time.
Yeah.
I think that's right. Now, again, one of the things I want to talk to you about is your participation or development of Expert at the Card Table show that you had done. And I wanted to talk a little bit about the development of that, I guess, and kind of, did you do that in London or in L.A., or where did you first start performing that show? And tell, first of all, about the concept of the show.
Sure.
What that was.
Well, so what happened was, now this probably was around the mid-90s, I would say. My friend Paul Wilson, R. Paul Wilson, he was living certainly in Scotland. I can't remember if he was in Edinburgh or in Glasgow at the time, but he still had a regular job, and but he was doing a lot of great magic, and he used to do a show at the Edinburgh Fringe Festival. So the Fringe Festival in Edinburgh is, I think, the biggest Fringe Festival
in
the world.
Did you ever work at Fringe Festival? I heard that's such a crazy thing.
Well, it absolutely is, and that was where I first did the show. So Paul used to do a show there every year, and one year he booked a space, really nice, very small space. It literally only had 20 seats in it, and he was going to do a card show there. And the main thing at Edinburgh is to make sure that people are aware of your show and know what it's about, because there are literally hundreds, if not now there are thousands of shows there. And, you know, you get a program and it's completely unmanageable. So he'd learned that you need to have a title of a show that instantly tells people what it's about. You know, that's kind of one of the things he thought was important. So he had decided not trying to be too clever. So the previous year, I think he'd called his show Sharp, which he thought was a good idea because it was like a card sharp, but he just realized it wasn't direct enough. So this year he said, I'm going to call my show The Expert at the Card Table, because that's, you know, a great name for a
very clear
show. So that's what he was planning on doing. As far as I know, he hadn't actually written the show, and I don't think he had any particular plans to tie it in with the book, but it was the name of the show.
Bird Nation.
So he then got called away on work, and I was at the time a student, so I had the time off over the summer. So he called me up, I mean, only a couple of weeks, I think, before the show, maybe a little more than that, but not much. and said, do you fancy doing a show at the Edinburgh Festival? And I'd always thought that would be fun to do. So I said, I'd love to. He said, well, the only thing is you need to call the show Expert at the Card Table because all of the fringe programs have already been printed. Mm. So I thought, well, that's fine. You know, I do card stuff and I do gambling routines. You know, that's fine. I'll do a show called Expert at the Card Table.
Right.
And about that time, I'd read an article in Genie magazine or a review in Genie magazine of the book The Man Who Was Erdnase, which was the one...
Whaley? Burt Whaley?
Yeah, it was Jeff Busby and Bart Whaley, and it was, you know, building on Martin Gardner's
right.
research about mm-hmm. the possibility that Milton Franklin Andrews was Erdnase. I mean, I have to say, I'm not particularly convinced by that theory, but it's a very interesting story.
Do you have a... person who you think it was? Who's your... Belief?
No, I don't. I don't have a great candidate, if I'm okay. honest.
I just had a long discussion with Dick Hatch, who's an expert on this, as
right?
Well, and he's got some. We talked for a half hour about this.
Okay. The only thing I've always wondered, if there were actually two authors, mm-hmm. and because obviously there are two aspects of it. There's the card slights aspect, the magic aspects, and the gambling aspect.
Well, that was one of the things he was talking about, where that it was belief perhaps that the fellow, when he went in and had, was it Durbin or whoever it was, the illustrator,
yeah.
may not have been talking to the actual guy. This guy may have been his emissary to say, I am acting on behalf of this, you know. And
oh, okay.
so, but if he was actually drawing the hands because there were no pictures
right.
of this, you know, then, so, but there's a belief, that's a point, that there could be two.
Yeah, well, I always wondered if it was a sort of a joint effort. And obviously, you know, the book is written in the first person plural. Mm-hmm. I mean, that was common at the time. So, you know, we suggest this, mm-hmm. we the other.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, you wonder about it. But then I think if you take... S.W. Erdnase in reverse is of course, E.S.
Andrews.
But, of course, S.W. is the two initials. If you take that away, so it's just Erdnase. If you just reverse Erdnase, you get E.S.A.N.D.R.E. You don't get the W.S.
Andres. Mm-hmm.
So I always wondered if it is in fact, is it E-S and R-E?
R-E. Oh, I see what you're saying. Oh, E-S and
yeah.
R-E, yeah.
So, that's, I mean, could it it could even potentially be something like Edwin Sachs, E-S, mm-hmm, mm-hmm, and mm-hmm. a gambler called R-E? You know, that's complete speculation. I have no mm-hmm. idea. But I always wondered if there was a possibility that it may be two people rather than one. So rather mm-hmm. than looking for one person, you're looking for two people who collaborated on the book. Who knows?
Mm-hmm. Well, that's another thing, too. It has to do with the people who have been identified as potential candidates. One was like 5'6", another one was 6'1".
Right.
And so perhaps that you're right. There could have been two, and they yeah. both would have had different heights.
Who knows? Yeah. Mm-hmm. So... yeah, I don't have a theory, but it seems unlikely that it was Milton Franklin Andrews. Mm. But the
good
story
any.
Of Andrews is kind of cool.
It is.
So
and there's a documentary that's being made about that right now.
Oh, is there?
Yes.
Oh, really?
Have you not been contacted by the
no,
show?
No, I didn't know.
Yeah,
about
there was a Kickstarter campaign for a while, and I did a podcast with the gentleman who was talking about all this, and he's doing some videos and everything, and he was soliciting some funds to help produce this. And
oh, interesting.
He is actually a producer of The Bachelor TV
okay,
show,
right.
a reality show. That's his full time job as a cameraman, you know, for this. But then on the part time, he's kind of putting together this thing.
Oh, interesting.
As to, you know, who your ideas are. You might ask Paul about that when you
okay.
see. Because he's involved with that.
Okay, that's
to some
interesting.
Degree.
Right.
Anyhow, go ahead.
So, my friend Chris Power had a copy of the book, and he lent it to me. I mean, literally, I picked it up as I was going to the airport to go up to Edinburgh. So, mm-hmm. I had my card show, and I was reading this book on the plane and thinking, wow, this is really cool. And so I was starting the show and just doing basically an hour of card tricks.
Right.
But
with
I
no
would
common
mention
thread necessarily.
Not really, yeah. no. But, you know, I mentioned, so this show is called Expert at the Card Table. That's actually the name of a really famous book. It's, you know, probably the most important book that's ever been written on card magic. Mm-hmm. Do another couple of card tricks. Then I talk about, you know, it's really fascinating because it's written by S.W. Erdnase, but no one who knows who that is. You know, mm-hmm. there's a lot of speculation about it. Then I'd do another couple of card tricks. Then I'd say, so there's a theory it might have been Milton Franklin Andrews. And, you know, he did this, this, and this.
So there's a nice running theme that you had.
So there was a bit of a theme in the background. And I found that people were, after the show, you know, just as interested, if not more interested in that than yeah. they were in the card tricks.
They were coming and asking you about
would,
this.
Yeah.
Well, that's interesting.
Yeah, it was. It also probably tells you something about the card tricks I was doing. But, you know.
need to go brush up on those a little
yeah.
bit. And just be a storyteller. Forget the tricks.
Well, I thought to myself, it does seem that there is interest here. Maybe there's something I should pursue. So I kind of then worked on the show after that to try and make it more about the book and worked on it and... did it at a few conventions, and I then kind of really started writing a proper script, and I've been working on that script on and off for 15 years. You know, I keep completely rewriting it and changing it and hopefully improving it. And then it was a few years later, I was... I'm friends with a producer in London and was chatting to him about... we play poker together and I was chatting to him about it. And the idea of doing the show again came up. And he had had a lot of experience. He runs a theatre in London, but he has a lot of experience at the Edinburgh Festival. Mm-hmm. So he said, well, let's do it at the Edinburgh Festival, but let's this time not do it in a really small place with no publicity. Let's actually do it properly and let's, you know, get some people to come and publicize right. the show and let's proper. Get a director in. Mm-hmm. So he had been working with Neil Patrick Harris on a play in London a little while before, and I'd played poker with Neil then as part of the group and got to know him a bit. And so the producer, David, and he were talking, and it all sort of came together. So we ended up doing a much updated and hopefully improved version of the show. This was in 2008, so probably about 10 years after the first time I'd done it, back up at the Edinburgh Fringe Festival. And this time we had a nice venue. It sat 120 people or something, which was kind of perfect, with raked seats. And it was much more of a proper show then, which had a proper script and it had, you know, a story behind it, which, again, it's loosely based on Milton Andrews, mm-hmm. You know, quite a few liberties I've taken with in order to sort of dramatize it. But it pursues the theme of the fact that magic, the book is half about magic and half about sleight of hand with cards and how the same sleights can be used for gambling and for magic, and but also is telling the story of Andrews, and it kind of has a twist at the end. So that was how it was then, and then since then I've done the show a few times, and I did it out in Santa Monica a little while ago, and I'm doing another run of it this year in London, all being well, over the summer. So I'm looking forward to doing that. And again, each time I do it, I hopefully change it for the better. Right?
And, so do you script it? I mean, you go back and kind of fine-tune that so you have something...
Oh, completely, yeah. Okay. It's pretty tightly scripted. So I'm on, I think, the 27th draft now. You know, it's been rewritten quite a lot.
90-minute show or how long?
It's about 75 minutes, hour okay. and a quarter. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And yeah, every time I do it, I sort of get some ideas. And I was actually working on another show. It was going to be a two-man show. More theatrical, and as a result of that, we ended up, I was doing it with a friend, we ended up working with a writer, and it just made me appreciate the importance of the script. I mean, it seems like an obvious thing to say, but I think as magicians, we sometimes lose sight of the fact that actually the script is so completely vital.
Our audience wants to see the trick, not the...
Right.
Yeah.
So I think I realized as a result of working on that show the weaknesses in the script of the Erdnase, the Expert at the Card Table show. So I've been trying to sort of go back and restructure it and do some other things with it and try to integrate the script with the magic a lot more. Mm-hmm. So hopefully this time, yeah, there'll be some more changes.
And so are there any plans in the future perhaps to come back to the U.S.? Or maybe, I mean, obviously with your indecision of whether that you want to put in for QC and move right. forward and how that might change your life, you have so many things right now, but is there any... one of those things that you're thinking about for your future include possibly coming over and doing a little short tour of that show?
At a sort of a high conceptual level, absolutely. You know, I'd love to do it. I haven't thought of any detail about when and where and how that might happen, but I really enjoy doing the show.
Sandy Marshall, you know, is a producer, and so, you know, from Magic Inc., you know,
right.
Sandy, yeah,
mm-hmm.
Because he's a producer and can do some things in New York and might have Chicago and maybe some other places you ought to talk with him about, maybe.
Oh, well, thanks, yeah. I mean, I really like doing the show. I kind of regret not having done it for a while, so I haven't done it for several years, and if it goes well, then I would love to pursue other opportunities to do it.
Sure.
And whether that would I mean, I always love coming over to the US, so yeah, that may well be something.
What is your favorite about. One of your favorite things to do, whether it's in that show or elsewhere? I mean, do you really like doing the Reformation, for an example, or I mean, what do you enjoy doing? I mean, a lot of times we do things for our audience, of course. I mean, there are some things that I have done and I then didn't do for a while and then realized, oh, the audience really likes this, and I put it back into my show, even though that I didn't care for it so much, and because I'm wanting to do something, and then I find out, well, who's the real audience here? Is it me or them? And so, okay, I've got to put this back in. But still, I'd rather I have fun doing something, you know, one little thing. What is it that you like to do?
Yeah, well, I mean, absolutely, but... One of the things I've always said, one of the joys of doing it as a hobby, not doing it as a profession, is that I can be a little selfish. You know, I do choose the things that I like doing, and you know, obviously, if an audience doesn't
hopefully
appreciate it,
like
then
it.
There's no point in doing it at all.
You won't have an audience.
Yeah, exactly. But I, you know, there are only things that I do that I really dislike, but I think, well, I guess I ought to do this because the audience like it. So I, you know, all the things I do, I enjoy doing.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have a particular favorite. I like doing the Reformation. Actually, in the show, The bit that worked well, I think the bit that worked best was a call to the colors routine, dealing, you know, reds and blacks. And I think the reason it worked so well is because it really did fit in and it's integrated into the story. Mm-hmm. So it's actually quite a long routine, but I'm hardly talking about the routine. You know, I introduce the premise. I introduce it as a premise of basically an exercise that gamblers use to combine sort of memory techniques with false dealing techniques so as mm-hmm. to make patterns out of the colors of the cards. So I sort of set up the premise, but then I'm sort of doing it almost absent-mindedly as I'm telling the story. And this is the part in the show when I'm talking about the sort of really fairly gruesome parts of Milton Andrews' life and when he's you know, accused of murdering his girlfriend and setting her body on fire to mutilate the corpse, all that kind of stuff. Mm. So I think it worked very nicely because the routine that I do, I deal the cards reds and blacks, and then I separate out the suits, and then the suits come out in numerical order as I'm dealing. But as I say, I'm hardly drawing attention to that. It's something that I'm doing almost sort of hypnotically as I'm telling this kind of gruesome story.
Right.
And that was the part a lot of people said that sort of was... That should be the model for the show, where you know the magic and the story were really integrated, mm-hmm. And so that's really what I've tried to focus on with the latest draft of the script, is to try and find ways that I can actually put more of the story in amongst the magic, rather than sort of telling a story and then sort of saying, well, now let me show you a magic trick that illustrates what I've been telling you about. I mean, I never said it quite like that, but that was the underlying theory.
Exactly.
You know, I'd sort of talk about someone, you know, crooked gamblers and doing this, that, and the other and hustling on street corners. Mm-hmm. And then there'd almost be a sort of pause and I'd do a kind of three-card Monty trick and then I'd get back to the story. Mm-hmm. And finding ways of actually integrating it is quite challenging, and particularly integrating it in a way that still retains some impact in the magic. Because, I mean, a lot of people have pointed out, in particular Juan Tamariz, you know, who's been amazing as always to watch this weekend, you know, the difficulties of actually combining storytelling with magic, because they're really pulling in opposite directions. And, mm-hmm. you know, if people are immersed in the story, they perhaps can't appreciate the impossibility of the magic. So trying to find ways of making the magic still have impact and yet fit within a story, it's a very interesting challenge.
Yeah, it is a challenge, I would think, because you want to have the audience to be with you for the whole thing and understand what's happening, and you don't want to insult their intelligence, I think, as you or Juan had said.
Yeah.
Like with a trade show magician, sometimes this card represents service and this card represents quality or whatever, or these rings or something, and you have to explain it. And then, but you want to have something that's very clear so that they understand.
Yeah.
You know, that part of it. So
yeah,
it makes perfect sense on there. Well, listen, I appreciate your time very much, and it's been great chatting with you over here. I had a lot of stuff that we covered.
Great, thanks.
was good. Now, the name of my podcast is called The Magic Word Podcast. And so let me ask, I always like to close by asking my guests, you know, what is it that your philosophy of life, what do you live by? What is not necessarily your word, like, I don't mean abracadabra, but like, you know, when you wake up in the morning, what is it that drives you, that's important, that you would live by? Perhaps a motto. It could change from day to day. It could be just at this moment, I believe this, and I'll ask you tomorrow, and you'll say, well, today I think this, or whatever. But you know what I mean?
Well, it's an interesting question. I don't have a particular answer in mind, but as you are asking the question, the thought came to my mind that I think at the moment I've got to a sort of a point in life. I'm 45 now, and it's amazing how quickly time goes. It seems not long ago I was the young kid doing card tricks, and now suddenly I come along to conventions and there are so many amazing young guys you know, I guess I still think of myself as younger, but I look around and I'm not.
And, hey, I can relate.
But I think I've really got to the stage where I'm really feel the urge to kind of be doing things, and I'm talking specifically from a magic point of view. You know, time can go by really quickly, and there are a lot of things I want to do and a lot of ideas I want to sort of to get out there. So I kind of feel the urge to actually sort of, at the end of a day, feel I have achieved something during that day. Mm-hmm. You know, I find actually I don't like days when I just sit around and do nothing. Even if I've been working quite hard, I don't want to just sit in front of the TV. You know, sure, I want to have some downtime, but I really find at the end of the day, I like to think, you know, I've actually achieved something, ideally created something, even if it's something only very tiny, and it might be something magic. I've got back into music. I mean, I used to play the piano a lot, and more recently I've started playing the piano, and I've actually been writing some music for my Expert at the Card Table show. So I'm really getting an enjoyment out of creating things and drawing. You know, that's something I've always enjoyed doing as well, sketching things. So I think at the moment, my slightly longer answer to that question is, my sort of thing that I would have during the day is at the end of the day to look back on the day and think, well, you know, what have I created today? And that sort of gives me a sense of achievement, which I really like. And it doesn't have to be a big thing, but just something I feel I'm that sort of creative side, I think I've missed a bit.
Right.
And I'm sort of coming back into doing that.
So look at every day as an opportunity to create something.
Create something, yeah.
Yeah, that's interesting. And then one last thing. I know that you write lecture notes and everything after this as well, but if somebody was interested, is your book available then, the Drawing Room Deceptions, or and also your lecture notes through the website or something if somebody wanted to get this?
Yes, my book is still available as far as I know. I don't keep copies of it, but it is available through various stores, and one can find it online. My lecture notes, I was very flattered. Everything sold out very quickly here at Magi Fest, which surprised me. But so I didn't. I obviously didn't bring enough. But I do still have lecture notes and a few other things on my website, which is just guyhollingworth.com.
Perfect.
And yeah, hopefully I'll be reprinting some things that have gone out of print that a few people have asked me about over the weekend. So yeah, I'm hoping as part of that kind of creativity drive, maybe things will be coming out again.
Well, good. Thank you again very much. And I want to kind of leave on that note, I think, to tell everybody to make sure that they think of every day of trying to create something. You know, don't go to sleep without thinking. You know, I remember, as a quick aside, Andre Cole telling me when he was in college, he said, I'm not going to go to sleep until I've invented three new ideas.
Right.
He said, they may not be perfectly worked out ideas.
Yeah.
You know, he said, where the money's not an object. It can cost $1 million or $1 billion, but it is something that can be done and accomplished. And he would drive himself to create three new ideas or magic tricks or something. They may be silly. They may be elaborate. It could be small or large or whatever. But, you know, he forced himself really to do that. So I think that's important to create every day. Great. Again, thanks very much, Guy. Appreciate your time. So for the Magic Word Podcast, that was Guy Hollingworth. This is Scotty out. Absolutely delightful. Wow. What a great conversation. That was just so much fun to sit down for a very informal, relaxed chat with Guy Hollingworth, one of the leading proponents of card magic in our world today. And I'm so glad that he shared some of his time with me, and we were able to share that with you, the listeners, and I hope that you guys enjoyed that as much as I did. That was just, classic. I love it, which is his style. Thank you, Guy. You are a classic and a classy guy. I hope that you guys will also follow some of the suggestions that he had made and go out and create some of your own original material then as well. Well, thank you guys very much for listening. One last plug. I want to remind you to go out to the magicwordpodcast.com. And if you have not already signed up for our newsletter, please do. That comes out each week, which is why it's called a weekly newsletter. It comes out simultaneous with this podcast. This comes out every Thursday at 9 a.m. Central Time. That's GMT plus 6. And also that we will tell you in the newsletter who it is that's on the episode that week and who's coming up next week, and also a suggestion from the archives. And also, just be sure you follow us then on Instagram if you're into that kind of social media thing, and Facebook, both at the Magic Word Podcast, or on, I think Instagram, just Scott Wells Magic. And on Facebook, it would be the Magic Word Podcast. So, enough for this week, and we'll be back next week with something completely different and completely enjoyable that I know that you're going to love. In fact, I'm really looking forward to next week's as well. If you are a subscriber to the newsletter and you've already read it, you know who it's going to be, but it's somebody who is up and coming and a lot of fun, and I know you're going to love listening to this next episode. So until next week, stay well, get booked, and look at every day as an opportunity to create something. This is Scotty out.